Coffee's ready. Guest is ready. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome back to the Prodigy Podcast. We are on episode 31. And today, in the lead up and anticipation to this Saturday's Polaris Squads event, I have the Team UK and Ireland captain, Dara O'Connell. How are you?
I'm great, man. Doing fantastic. Thanks for having me on. How are you doing?
All well. Excited that we're finally getting a Polaris show back on our screens, if you will. I thought a good question to start off would be, as well as an accomplished jiu-jitsu competitor, you're a rugby player in your former years. And I wondered if the team dynamics of how the team dynamics compare of a jiu-jitsu squads event to maybe a rugby event, or have you drawn any comparisons as you've now, this will be your second event?
I actually didn't think of that myself, to be honest. But I guess there's similarities for sure. You have to motivate a group of people to complete a task together. I guess the only difference is we're still competing as individuals, you know, as the rugby team, you're all collectively on the pitch together performing at one time. So I guess the difference here is we still, even though we have the team, we'll still fight by ourselves. So I guess that's maybe the difference, but that's what I prefer a lot about jiu-jitsu to rugby. You have responsibility for yourself and your own actions, whereas playing rugby, there's 14 other people alongside yourself, and you can perform as much as you want. If the other 14 aren't interested or don't want to, you know, or sometimes the others can make mistakes, and or you can make mistakes and cost everyone else. But I think what's nice in jiu-jitsu is that you're responsible for your own actions, you know.
And I guess it's the best of both worlds for you then. You're able to have that element, and that's what's so great about these Polaris Squads event, is that you're able to get the benefit of the team dynamic and team competition, yet you do still get to keep your individualism, you still get to keep the pressure on yourself and the control, like all jiu-jitsu fighters and all of us like to do. We like to keep the control in our own hands as much as we can.
It's that's the thing that I liked the most when I started doing jiu-jitsu after rugby, was being able to be responsible for your own actions. It definitely, it made me feel a lot more nervous at first, but it's definitely a lot better now.
And how have preparations gone for this event? I know that you went and trained up with Adam Varginski, and obviously your own training back at ECJJA. But how have preparations felt for this event?
So actually, like for everybody, I guess the last year has been quite a crazy, crazy time. For me, it was a bit unique insofar as last November, like with Ireland being closed and the academies being shut, everything, actually in Ireland, everything has been shut up until recently, restaurants, bars, close to absolutely everything. So in November last year, I kind of got sick of everything, and I have friends in both Sweden and in Spain, and they could train there. So I made about a month trip to go to Sweden and Spain, and I was able to train. Of course, there was some restrictions and different things, but I could train. And I came home in December, and I thought, wow, like the contrast of coming back to nothing from being able to train and doing everything was a big one. And I made the decision to go to Brazil at the start of January of this year, and I actually stayed there until about halfway through June. I think I left Brazil June 17th, so I was in both Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo for about 6 months since January, and there it was amazing, man. Like, of course, there is restrictions and some certain things, but for me, the two main things was, one, you could train freely, and two, you can compete. They still have competitions every single weekend. So I was in a very unique situation where at home my academy was suffering and everything, you know, was on a downturn, but I was able to be somewhere where I could train, I could compete regularly, focus purely on myself and not actually have to coach anybody, not have to run the business, not have to worry about anything really. You know, often when I go to tournaments, I have 40, 50 students with me. I have to look after them as, and then try to also compete myself. So it was a very, very much the best of a bad situation. And I got to do maybe 11 to 12 tournaments while I was there. So very regular competition. A lot of it was gi competition as opposed to no gi competition. I was training every day, you know, competing all the time. And then because of the restrictions, you can't travel from Brazil to Ireland. Don't ask me why, but you're not allowed to travel from Brazil to Ireland. So you can go for some reason to Poland for 2 weeks, stay there for 2 weeks. And then when you come to Ireland from Poland, they only ask you, where have you been for the last 2 weeks? So the answer was Poland. So, and that's acceptable. So that's how I ended up linking up with Adam, because it was one of the only places that, well, I mean, obviously Adam is awesome, a good friend, and really, really good training there. But it was also somewhere where I could go and they would let me come in from Brazil. And in Poland, you same, you can train, you can do whatever you like. It was awesome. So I kind of finished up my trip by training there for 2 weeks. And then for the last, I want to say 4 weeks now, I've been back in Dublin. We reopened the academy. Everything is moving more along like normal, in inverted commas, I suppose, as normal as things can be nowadays, you know?
I think that's it's quite interesting, because you've actually been able to solely focus on yourself. I mean, when was the last time that you had the opportunity where, like you say, you could be a bit selfish? I mean, most athletes have to be a bit selfish, but when you are running your own gym and yeah. coaching your students and things like that, it doesn't give you that much opportunity to do so.
Yeah, I think for me, again, my situation has always been unique. I started teaching when I was only 22 years old, right after I got my purple belt. So for a huge majority of my career, actually, that has been the case. I've had to think about others and run the gym and teach classes. So like, it's kind of always been part of the fabric of my development. So that kind of made it even starker contrast, because since the last 10 years, 2010 was when I started the gym. And for the last 10 years, it's been growing and growing and growing and growing and growing. And as it grows, there's more students, there's more responsibility, there's more traveling, there's more things to do at the academy. And, you know, it really all starts to add up. And if you want to ask when was the last time I got to be selfish like that, man, 12 years ago, maybe, when I was a blue belt or something, you know, I had only just started training. And actually back then, the training was so terrible that being selfish didn't really benefit you too much anyway, because we weren't smart enough to, you know, there wasn't even enough training. There was a couple sessions a week, two or three trainings, people just killing each other, you know, like it really didn't matter. So it was so, so nice. Like, I love teaching. I love my job. My life is amazing, but it was really, really nice, like, to just get that contrast and be able to just think about me. I can go to the gym. I don't have to be there early to open the gym. I don't have to clean the mats. I don't have to make sure the toilet is not broken. I don't have to fix the showers. I can just go and just sit there, get ready for the class, be in the class. Somebody else is telling you what to do. I don't have to tell everyone what to do. I'm training from the very start of the class till the very end of the class. Normally, if I'm teaching a class, I'm there early. I'm doing all these different things. I'm teaching the class for 45 minutes. I'm cold, and then you have to try to start training yourself. Whereas there, I'm through the whole training. I have no obligation to help anybody. You know, as a coach, you roll with everybody, and there's always that moment after you roll with every one of your students where they kind of look at you like, okay, so tell me something, you know, tell me what should I improve? How did I do, you know? And, you know, this is a natural thing, but it was really nice to have no obligation. I can just roll and get my ass kicked or kick someone's ass and just, okay, next, you know, like just move on to the next one and just be.
And I guess it gives you that opportunity to self-critique as well during your role.
Yeah, because
kind of give you that time to mull over.
Yeah, and this for me is huge, you know, like some of the time when you're training, like my students will ask me, oh, you know, what should I work on or what should I improve? And, you know, honestly, sometimes the answer is I'm concentrating on myself. I was working on trying to do this particular move. I actually didn't pay attention. I'm sorry to be rude, but I actually didn't pay attention at all to what you were doing. I was just trying to, you know, every time I train, I have specific goals within my training, things I'm trying to work on. And every day I'm trying something different. And sometimes I'm just in my own world and I actually am paying attention to you personally. I'm paying attention to what I'm doing and you're just a blank face giving me reactions, you know? So it's, you know, sometimes this is a difficult thing as the coach. You have to be able to give feedback, et cetera. So in Brazil, man, I have no obligation to anybody. I can just train and, you know, move on to the next. And as you said, just think solely about myself, which for me was a huge, huge contrast after a very long time not being able to do that.
And I guess similar to the training as well, the fact that you were able to compete so often, regardless if it was in the gi, for this particular Polaris competition, but just competing that often and that regularly just was of a huge benefit in the same way.
Man, so nice. Like that's the life for me, you know, is training and then every week having a competition on the weekend to get that feedback, because the competition just informs your training. You know, whatever happens in the competition is what is going to affect what happens in the train. It gives you direction, you know, it's such clear direction as to what needs to be done. And when you can fight that regularly, man, you have continuous direction with your training. And you also have a way better, the direction is just so much more clear. And you have a way better chance to experiment because you're going to compete every weekend. And because it's only just driving 20 minutes down the road, you have the ability to try different things, try a new strategy because, okay, I'm going to fight next weekend too. So I can try something new. It's not that big of a deal. No, I've spent my whole life fighting out of Ireland. We have to fly every single weekend if we want to compete. We have to get a flight. We have to get a hotel. We have to get taxis, trains, buses, registration fees. It's quite a lot of money to do it. And, you know, it's an ordeal in and of itself just going to the competition. So to be able to just drive down the road and fight high level black belts weekend after weekend is something I realize now is very, very difficult for us to compete with or replicate here in Dublin. It's really, really a difficult situation that we're in. And I guess it took me 15 years to realize how much of a disadvantage we really are at, you know?
And that fact that, especially when you move to that higher, that black belt level where you are competing more so at invitationals and, you know, big events where they're kind of either where they're individual matches or squad matches, being able to go back to the kind of, you know, the blue belt life of competing every weekend and having the availability where there isn't that preparation for a lead up to one big event and then starting that process all over again. Like you say, it just gives you room to breathe.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's something I try to emphasize a lot to my students. Of course, we have the big things we want to win. You know, you have the big competitions, but competing is just competing. And it's just being able to tap into that zone where you're rolling and feeling like your best self. And the more regularly you can do it, the easier it is to tap into that performance. And when you build up to a big event, it's so easy to put too much emphasis on, okay, we're going to do the Europeans. It's going to be in 12 weeks from now. We're preparing for this. We're preparing for this. We're preparing for this. And then the day comes and you can so easily be overwhelmed by the occasion. And I think it's really important to, you know, almost put, it's a dichotomy. You have to put a lot of significance on the occasion because, okay, this is the time when it really counts, but also, you really have to almost pretend like it doesn't matter at all. You know, you have to just, it's just like any other competition. It doesn't matter if it's Polaris, if it's a small competition in Brazil, if it's, you know, just a super fight at the end of training, it's all the same thing. You're just going to roll with someone and you're just trying to perform your moves over their moves. And I think sometimes we can blind ourselves or paralyze ourselves by putting too much emphasis on, oh, this is the one, you know, this is the one I've been waiting for 12 weeks. And, you know, if you're just fighting every single week, if you're just fighting every single weekend, it's just another event, you know. It's just another chance to go and try to do your moves. And I think sometimes we can paralyze ourselves. And I think I'm in a very good position in my career now where, look, of course, this Polaris is a fantastic lineup, amazing athletes, a fantastic opportunity. But for me, it's just another awesome chance to just try to do some jiu-jitsu and just try to improve myself, you know. So, like, I'm simultaneously grateful and think it's a great opportunity. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's just another competition to me.
And I think that's good advice for everyone to take, especially, I think, you know, given the situation that a lot of people in where they are returning to training and are returning to competition, they may put more emphasis on the fact that, you know, this is their first competition. And people like to put things on a pedestal when when it's been a while, when they've had time away from things. But they should just treat it. It's just a try and get your best role in, essentially.
Man, that's it, man. Nothing, like, without, I don't know what the term is, but none of it matters, you know, especially at the beginner level. Like, man, it really doesn't matter. Like, your first 50 competitions, like, it's all just building experience. It doesn't even matter. Like, white belt can go and win and you think you're great, but you're still terrible, you know. And you can go and you can lose and you think you're terrible. You think, oh, I'm so terrible. It's like, God, everyone's terrible, you know. Like, it doesn't matter if you won, if you lost, you're still just a beginner. And even if you're a blue belt and you win or you lose, you're still just finding your feet. Purple belt, you're still, you know, it takes so long to get to the point where it's actually significant, where it actually matters. You know, for very, very few people in the jiu-jitsu community does it, you know, inverted commas, actually matter. You know, it's really only at that elite level where it actually matters. And even then, in jiu-jitsu, the beautiful thing is, man, nobody remembers our record. Nobody remembers how many times we've won, how many times we've lost. You can try an infinite amount of times. And, you know, the funny thing is, some of the things I'm the most proud of, no one even knows about or remembers. And some of the things that I really didn't think too much about are the things that people remember all the time. So, you know, you can work up in your head, oh, this is important or that's important. And, you know, at the end of the day, none of it matters other than your own improvement and your own enjoyment. And I see so many times beginners, intermediate level people quitting jiu-jitsu because of competition, you know, because they won a competition, because they lost a competition, because they, oh, I wanted to win this and then I lost the first round. And, you know, jiu-jitsu is just a great, healthy thing to enjoy and to help you. And it competition is just a little tool alongside that. So I don't know, just take it seriously, but don't take it too seriously, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it's like we should, you know, we encourage people. There's a lot of thing about encouraging people to compete, but we shouldn't put the emphasis should be on enjoying the competition and, you know, testing yourself and experimenting and, you know, and just finding things out about yourself rather than especially for people who aren't looking to be professional athletes. It's not all about the medal podium, because again, if you've won the South End Open, no one's going to remember by the next one.
Yeah, man. And even bigger competitions, I've won some bigger competitions that majority of people I speak to actually probably don't even know that I won. And it's all about you, your own personal, what are you trying to get out of this, you know? And realistically, where are you within the scheme of things? You know, if you have a normal job and you train a lot, you know, there's always going to be someone who can train more than you and can dedicate more than you. So if you go to the Europeans and you don't win, yeah, I'm sorry, but of course you didn't win. It would have been amazing. It would have been unbelievable if you managed to win, you know? Like, it's so, the level nowadays is so high, and it's just about being realistic within your own space. And hey, of course, you've got to enjoy yourself. But I also think it's cowardly to not try to win. You should try. Like, don't just go and say, well, let's see what happens. You know, I'm just here to have some fun. No, be realistic. What are you there to do? Are you like, go and try to fight and try to win? Don't just go and say, let's see what happens. You know, let's see what happens is let's go and give myself a reason for losing already. You know, like, try your best, exactly. Prepare as best you can, and go in there to try to win. But also, if you don't win, it's not the end of the world, and it doesn't mean that you have to quit. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, Europeans will come around the next year and then you try again. I think that you that point you made earlier is fantastic. Everyone in combat sports, I think we try and put on the same rule. We try and apply the same rules that we do to MMA and boxing and things like that, of that, oh, well, this person's 5-0 or this person wins and losses. In jiu-jitsu, you have an infinite, you might as well keep your losses number on zero. It doesn't matter if you've lost or not. Just keep it on zero because no one cares.
Yeah, I think there's a saying you see sometimes, like, the master has failed more times than the beginner has even tried. And man, I think at one point I used to write down all my matches, like every single match I had. I had like a number of matches I had, and I stopped counting once I got to black belt. And I think in black belt I've had over 100, and in the lower belts I had easily 300, 350. So let's say I've had 500 matches as a rough estimate. Okay. If I've had 500 matches, for sure I lost about 200, 250 of those matches. Like, it's actually insane how many times you would have lost. Has anybody, like, you know, if you're asking yourself, have you tried enough? Have you lost 250 times? Like, and I lost 200.
Maybe that should,
I'm still trying.
Yeah, maybe that should be, you know how we have there's the 10,000 hour rule. Maybe that should be what it is for jiu-jitsu. It should be until you get to 250 losses, don't bother. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Once you get to that point, then we can talk.
Yeah. And even then, man, I don't worry about it. And I have those, you know, so even then it doesn't even matter. It all becomes very funny. I think the more experience you get, you know, when you see people making such a big deal out of such non-events, it's like, man, in 2 years you won't care about that, you won't remember about that, you'll actually look back at yourself and laugh at, fuck, I can't believe I took that so seriously, you know, or I can't believe I, now again, it's like a dichotomy, you have to take it seriously to be good, you know, like you do have to take it seriously, but you know, just keep moving forwards, don't let anything break you down. Jiu-jitsu is just rolling around on the ground with your friends at the end of the day, you know, it's not that serious.
Should get that on a t-shirt. Well, I mean, you touched on it before. Obviously Saturday's show is coming up. What I found interesting, and I wondered, was that the makeup of the UK Ireland team is different. It's slightly different from the last one. Yeah. And I wonder what new dynamics does that bring to the team? You've got the like of Ross Nichols, Dan Strauss, Ben Dyson, to say a few, but you've got some new members to the team. How has that changed the dynamics? Has that kind of made you consider different things when approaching the competition?
Yeah, I think probably the first thing I thought was both Dan and Ben are much bigger than some of the people we had on the team before. So this, I think, just in general is a good thing. Like, okay, obviously everyone has to make 95. It's under 95 for the bigger guys. So everyone will weigh in the same. But I just think in a 5-minute match, sub only, the bigger you are, the better it probably is, right? Like, I would certainly rather be way, way bigger than someone than much smaller than someone, right? So I think this can be useful strategically. We have a better opportunity to put someone much bigger than someone else that, you know, in theory should be tougher to submit, or, you know, should be more difficult to finish. So that was kind of the first thing that came to my mind was exactly this. And then also to have Ross too, man, Ross is so, so good, you know, like he hasn't fought in quite a while now, I don't think, but man, the guy is, you know, in my opinion, probably the best no-gi competitor that the UK has produced. You know, he's qualified for ADCC. He won the trials with basically all submissions. Incredible athlete and, you know, such a good addition to have. And I think with how much the leg lock game has become such a huge part of the sport, to have someone who's, you know, another specialist in leg locks is going to be really, really useful, because people who do leg locks, very, very, now touch wood, and no pressure on Ross not to get leg locked, but people who usually do leg locks, they very rarely get leg locked, you know. It's like they're so comfortable in those exchanges that I think that would be a really, really good addition to the team. He's very dangerous himself, and you know, very rarely see Ross in a bad situation, and same with Dan and Ben, you know, they're so durable and so tough. I think this will help a lot too. So yeah, I think, you know, whoever we got in there, everyone brings something different. And I think, like, for sure, Ben and Dan are dangerous in their own ways too. But, you know, also that little bit of size, I think will play a bit of a part. You know, you imagine Dan Strauss versus Gio Martinez, for example. Like, Dan is significantly bigger than Gio. Ben is significantly bigger than Adam Benayoun, is one of the guys who got traded in. He's Ryan Hall black belt. You know, that size, it can't be ignored in a 5-minute match. It's definitely a big part. Same with on their side, they have Thor. I don't know his blank. John Blank, is that his name?
Yeah, John Blank.
I just always call him Thor, but yeah, that's his nickname. But man, he's very, very big too. Like, significantly bigger than Tom Halpin. So, you know, as skilled as Tom Halpin is, it's very, very difficult to overcome the size once the skill level is the same, you know. So I think having the bigger guys, you know, that's probably for me something that's changed the dynamic a little bit.
And similarly, do you kind of place, how much importance do you place on understanding your team's skill set and their styles? Is there obviously you most of these people you'll have either trained with at some point or interacted with to a degree, or you've been, you know, they were on the previous squad. So how much importance do you place on understanding that stuff?
Yeah, I think, like, it definitely makes a difference. You've got to know I don't think you have to. I think just if you're involved at the high level, you're always paying attention to everybody on the scene. So, you know, I know everybody on their team. As you said, I've trained and or competed with quite a lot of them also. And even if I haven't, I'm well aware of them, what their style is. Same with the people on my team. I've trained with or competed with a lot of them. And even if I haven't, I'm well aware of what their style is and how they match up well. So, I think, yeah, it's definitely important to know and to think about. But, you know, also at the high level too, I think very much everybody is really prepared for everything. Anyway, you know, I think all of the guys know, especially the no-gi game now has become so condensed. You know, it's so much, it's just leg locks all over. It's always leg locks, heel hooks, all types of leg locks and back takes, basically. I think now, what I would expect to see from the competition on the weekend is a lot of leg lock attempts and then a lot of back take attempts from people trying to do leg locks. You know, I think this is probably going to be the most common thing you'll see. There's still a lot of front headlock attacks, darces, anacondas, guillotines, things like this. But I think those two are kind of your two main things. You're going to see a lot of guillotine, darce, anaconda attacks and leg lock / back attacks. I think these are the two most common things. So I think all of our team and all of their team are aware of both of these types of things. And I think more the strategical element will be, okay, one of their smaller guys just won and is staying on. Okay, let's throw a bigger guy because, you know, the bigger guy is going to have a better chance. Okay, one of our guys has won two or three in a row and he's about to be tired and fight one of their bigger guys, let's pull them out. So I think some of the strategy is more on the knife, seeing how it unfolds. It can be kind of hard. Yeah. It can be kind of hard to plan. You know, there's people who I think in my mind, okay, this person versus this person would be a better matchup, but it can be quite hard to actually make that unfold until you see how it's happening on the knife, if that makes some sense.
Yeah, and there's that point. I guess I wouldn't want to be in the shoes, in your shoes at that point, but where you do see, I don't know. So, I mean, even Richie Martinez is on the larger side on their team, but someone like that, and you just think, oh, do we want to throw our big guy in yet? Do we want to throw Dan in yet?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's it. It's like, yeah. It becomes difficult to say until you're kind of in that particular moment. And yeah, I guess, you know, that's the beauty of it. I guess it's going to be pretty exciting.
And what was I going to say? Oh, in terms of the front headlock game, what I think is quite interesting is that both you and Dan Strauss do, picking on him again, do have a a vast array of guillotine and a large guillotine repertoire. Uh-huh. And how much do you think that will come into play? Do you think that when people are preparing for this, they are considering tactics around that? Or do you think it is going to be that people will just play their own styles just because of the vast amount of competitors?
Yeah, I think the one thing with guillotines, at least in my opinion, is that it's much easier to start off a match by stopping someone grabbing your head than it is to stop someone grabbing your legs. So, like, strategically, if I want to go into a match and say, I'm not going to let someone grab my head for the whole match, this is a much, much easier thing to achieve than I'm not going to let someone grab my legs. So, you know, while the guillotine and the upper body attacks are strong, it can be hard to find an opportunity for them to present themselves, especially if, as you said, the other team know, okay, if you go with Dan or Dara, don't let them get to your head. This can be a more difficult thing. So whereas with the legs, that's, I think, why it's so prevalent. If you're on the top, the first thing you run into when you're trying to pass someone's guard is their legs. The first thing you're trying to get to when you're trying to attack someone on the bottom will be their legs. So I think it can be a little bit easier maybe to game plan around stopping us get to the head than it can be stopping a leg locker get to the legs. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and there is a larger amount of opportunity there, like you say, from both sides of the coin as well.
Mm-hmm. And because the wrestling, because there's no points, wrestling becomes less significantly important. And if someone has no incentive to try to put you down with a takedown or an aggressive come up on the sweep, it means your head is not as available. You know, like it's a lot of the time in the takedown or the wrestling scramble where the head becomes available. So, you know, with that out of the picture too, you know, for me, I know both Richie and Gio Martinez are very good with the guillotine also, and the darce, the front headlock. Nick Ronan actually is very good with this too, the Enzo Gracie member of the team from their side. So if I fight with them, my intention for sure will be to try to not let them go near my head, try to keep my legs in front of me, don't let them get to my head. So, you know, I'm not going to try to wrestle up on sweeps. I'm not going to try to shoot a double leg. You know, it makes no sense to try to do those types of things. And I'm sure the same works the other way around, you know? So yeah, I guess it's just the strategy based on the rules.
And would it be remiss of me to not mention your opponents? How have you found them? Like how have you compared them when you've looked at your previous opponents in Team Europe? What are your thoughts on the team's makeup? I know that there is, I think, four 10th Planet guys, all of a variety of styles. It has to be said, but it may make a difference.
Yeah. I don't know. I think like the Team Europe we fought were really, really good, man. There were a lot of studs in there, just as much as there was for this event, the one that's coming up. I think Richie and Gio in particular have some very particular 10th Planet things they like to do, especially Richie has a good own plata, go-go plata, carny, I think is what 10th Planet people call it. But like this like rubber guard style game, I know he's very strong with this. But the other two, from what I've seen, like John Blank seems very much like a heavy butterfly, leg lock type guy, you know, more the modern style of no-gi. Like he doesn't seem, at least in my time watching him, I haven't seen too much like 10th Planet like style from him. And then I think they actually just swapped PJ Barch for Nate Orchard. I think PJ Barch got injured. So something like that, he got hurt, he couldn't do it. So they swapped him for Nathan Orchard, who's another 10th Planet guy. Now, what I would have known about PJ Barch is he's a wrestler, very heavy on the top position, whereas Nathan Orchard is a bit of everything. You know, he plays bottom, he plays top. So I think he has, you know, I think he plays a bit of rubber guard as well. I know he has a dangerous close guard. But you know, like I just think at the top level, like it's all about just doing your own positions and avoiding someone else's positions, you know? So whether it's a 10th Planet guy or a
Danaher death squad guy or a, you know, someone from Norway training in Frontline. Like people who are good are just good at the end of the day, and it's just avoiding those positions. So yeah.
And you mentioned it before. What there is a 5 minute round time for each fight. Do you prefer that? Is that, I mean, if I were to do the kind of bingo of different types of formats, different competition formats, I feel like you would have ticked most of the boxes. Uh-huh. But how does that compare in, to other competitions? Do you prefer it?
It's hard to say because nowadays in jiu-jitsu, there's so many like types of rules and lengths of matches and points, no points, short, long. I fought a few times in Brazil in like the AJP is like the Abu Dhabi Pro rules, and these are shorter fights. These are only 6 minutes, 5 minute matches, depending on adult or masters. And I like the shorter matches, honestly. I think there's more stuff happens. Like a 10 minute match with points can be very slow and very, very tactical. Whereas the shorter the time, I think people work much more. But when it's submission only, I think it's hard to, you know, it's hard to hit submissions in 5 minutes, you know. That's not to say that this won't be the case on the weekend, but I just think, you know, it incentivizes sometimes when it's submission only and there's short time, it can incentivize the opposite of what the organizers want, which is they want action and they want submissions. But if I'm a competitor and I'm someone who doesn't want to lose, and I'm in a bad position, I look at the clock. Okay, 2 minutes have gone. There's only three left. I'm just going to try to survive the rest of this 3 minutes rather than if it's a decision, a judge's decision where you have to show that you were fine. You know what I mean? So it's like it's a short amount of time. It can be hard to open someone up. And it also is shorter time for someone to decide, okay, I'm just going to hold out here. You know, I'm just going to try to, you know, on the last squads, I fought with my friend Santeri. Very big guy from Finland. He lives in Spain, but he's from Finland. And he's very, very big. He's very powerful. And after maybe a minute and a half or 2 minutes of fighting with him, I was like, man, this guy's power is – his positioning and his power is huge. It's going to be a tough ask for me to get something going here. But I know I can survive until the end and not get submitted. So, you know, that's where you kind of run into that dynamic. I think the shorter match – makes it more exciting, but it also makes it easier for someone to decide to not be exciting, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, if those were individual matches, if it was, well, you're either going to draw or you're going to get the sub, then maybe that does then encourage you more to go for the submission so you can get the win. But when it is in that team format, unless you're the last man in the squad to step up, if you know that there's someone after you, I do get what you mean. It can encourage you to just kind of hold out and just not think about just making sure that you don't get subbed.
Yeah, and look, there's the difficult thing with all of these shows and trying to make jiu-jitsu exciting is at the end of the day, what we're doing is sport. It's a sport. Of course, Polaris is for entertainment, but we're sports athletes competing in a sport. And sometimes, maybe a lot of the time, sports is not about excitement. It's about the athletes trying to best each other within the rule set that's given. And no one cares sometimes. Like, it's a very, very, very rare thing within jiu-jitsu that you find someone like Tommy Langacker, like Fionn, who they don't care. They're just going to go. You know, they don't think about the strategy. They don't think about anything other than just going. This is like the 0.01%. The rest of people, they want to game the rules and they want to win, or they want to do as much as possible to not lose, you know? And it's like, you can't, it's so hard to force people into being exciting for the sake of entertainment. What we're doing is a sport. Sometimes Real Madrid play Barcelona, and yeah, they're two amazing lineups of football, but it's nil-nil. It's completely boring and nothing happens, you know? It doesn't matter that you took the two best teams. Sometimes when people, there's a lot at stake, there's cameras on you, there's eyes on you. You just want to do whatever it is within the rules to get the result that you need. And the organizers, I think a lot of the time, are thinking so much about, okay, if we do this, it'll make it exciting. If we do this, the athletes think the complete opposite way. Okay, here's the rules. How can I make sure that I do what I need to do within these rules to get the result? You know, like, it's just the way that it is. It's sports. It's not entertainment. If you want entertainment, we need to just make pro wrestling, or we need to just make, like, that's actually the root of pro wrestling is from catch wrestling.
Yeah.
Catch wrestling used to be a sport where you try to submit each other. It was really exciting at first. People started getting better. It started becoming more boring because they equaled each other out. And then, hey, no one wants to watch this anymore. So let's fix the matches and make it, you know, some crazy shit that people are going to like. And that's the birth of pro wrestling. So I think we have to be very careful about how much we emphasize the entertainment and excitement factor, because, man, at the end of the day, what we're doing is sports. It's martial arts. We're trying to best each other within whatever rules you give us. We're athletes. We want to win. We're not there to be your puppets, to just be exciting, you know? Like, we're trying to do our best to win, and I'm sorry sometimes if it's not exciting, but it's just the way that it is, you know? I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah, and actually, well, there's 2 points. First, I think actually the shorter matches, those AJP rules, but on points, I think that is one way where it's not allowing opportunity to gamify, because the points rule set is still there, but it does encourage you, because if you are a couple of points down, you're going to be encouraged to not spend some time you're going to go after, you know, either subbing them or trying to regain and get on top on points with some urgency. So I do quite like that for kind of points based competition. But the other thing, the history of, it ended up that the Hippodrome in London was full of old catch wrestlers people were queuing outside, but they were just fixed matches and they were purely based on entertainment. And the Americans can thank us for that, because that's how they got WWE and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's it. I think you got to be careful with how much value you place on entertainment over two actual athletes just trying to win a game. You know, it's amazing when you get those athletes like your Fionns, your Tommy Langackers, who are just exciting regardless. They throw it to the wind and they just go for it. But man, this is the, out of how many jiu-jitsu athletes can you name that are like them too? You know, it's a vast, vast minority. So, you know, I can't pretend like I'm any different. You know, if I find myself in a bad position, man, I'm not going to just do something crazy to make it exciting. Yeah. I don't want to be tapped. I'm going to try to not be submitted. If I'm in bottom mount or side control, man, I'm going to do what's right to make sure I don't get submitted. And you've made the rules so that if I get submitted, it's points for their team. So I don't want to give points for their team. That's just as valuable to me as submitting someone on their team, you know? So you have to play the rules that are put in front of you. We're competitors. We're sportsmen. We want to win, you know, you want to win. If it's not exciting, tough look, go watch something else. I'm competing for me in my sport. If you don't want to watch, you don't understand what's going on. I'm not there to just be exciting for exciting's sake, you know? So it's amazing when it is exciting, and it's you know, it's great, but how many football matches are played every weekend that are the most boring fucking things you ever see in your life, you know? And that's the most popular sport in the world. That's the sport that everybody is watching, you know? So there you go.
I think if we, I'm not a football fan, but I am going to talk about football for a second. But if I think what the reason why that is because it's about the fans' love of the sport. It's not about them wanting to see. The fans want the win as much as the team. And so even if it's, you see when people walk away and they go, you hear football fans go, we won, it was a boring match, but at least we won 2-0. They talk as the same as the competitors, whereas I think we need to get to that point in jiu-jitsu where, and it's more difficult because we're not in a team-based competition, but the teams-based sport predominantly, that people want the win as much as the competitor. They're not fussed whether they get it.
Yeah, yeah.
How they get it, shall I say.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I think, like, yeah, I guess the only similarity you can get with that is when you get to an Olympic level or a World Cup level where it's your country, you know? Like, it's the same for, like, in Ireland. Man, we get behind anybody who is good in anything because we're very rarely good at a lot of high-level sports. So, like you said, people feel like it's them, you know? It's when, like, when Conor McGregor is fighting, it's like, yeah, like, Conor is us, you know? It's like, it's everybody. It's, whereas in jiu-jitsu, because it's so segmented between academies and teams and all sorts of different things, you know, only my students are looking out for me. It's not the entire of the whole country, or you know. So it's like exactly like how you said, I never thought about that angle. All the fans of football, they all want the outcome for the team, so they don't care if it's boring or not. It's, did my team win or lose, you know? That's the kind of the end product of it all. So yeah, if we could get to a point where it's more developed and each country actually has its own representatives, then I think people will be much more enthusiastic, because to me, watching soccer is like watching gambling. It's like you just randomly pick one red or black, you just pick a side, and you have your side in the roulette, and it's a complete lottery that you have no control over whether it wins or loses. And that's part of why it's exciting, because you have no control. Yeah. It's like, okay, I picked black, what's it going to be today? Is it going to be red or is it going to be black? Oh, it's black, yeah, I feel amazing, you know? Like, oh, it's red, devastating, you know? Like, it's exciting because you have a dog in the fight. Whereas with jiu-jitsu, people are going to watch this event, and it's nice that they've made the, like, UK, Ireland, and the USA or whatever, to try to kind of bring this, you know, get the whole of Ireland and the UK behind us, get the whole of, you know, but I think the reality is we're still far from that point where people relate to me and the other Irish guys as like, okay, this is the actual Irish team, you know, this is like, mm-hmm. of jiu-jitsu, this is like our guys who are in there, you know. It's still very far from that, but it's a great point what you said. I never thought about it that way. It's definitely true.
Well, the only time I think this may be more of a personal thing, but so for example, when the last ADCC was on, whether they were UK or Ireland, it was, whether it be Fionn or Ross or Ben, it was, come on, like, it was, I mean, it's the closest thing we have to the Olympics, but that's what it was. It was that kind of anticipation of, well, you know, they're from our neck of the woods. And yeah, there was something about that. And again, but they are individual competitors. But I think there's something about, because ADCC is an international competition and because it draws the highest level of competitors, it almost flirts with the idea of that kind of Olympic nationalist or nationalistic or pride and things like that. Maybe they should have ADCC, but generally essentially an Olympics, but like an ADCC, but teams for countries or something like that. But again, you fall into the same problem that you do with other squads events, which is, what happens if you've got one person who is far, you know, levels ahead of the rest of the team and things like that?
It's definitely difficult.
Well, we've got some user questions, Instagram questions that people asked. So yeah, I thought I'd make sure that those are in them.
For sure.
Some of them are more down around the team, and the others are, I think, are trying to just get instructional advice from you. Sure. The first one being, what words of encouragement do you say to the team, maybe before the event or just as they step onto the mat?
I think, you know, I'm there as the captain solely because they've put that as a thing that's in there, you know. It's like, I'm the captain, but man, I'm also not, you know. It's like, we're all just there together, you know. Like, they're all fully grown men. They don't need me to tell them, hey, fucking, you can do it, Tom. You know, you can do it, Dan. It's like, I'm pretty sure they know that they can do it, you know. Like, we're all there together. And of course, man, I'll say, hey, fucking, let's get them, boys, you know. But like,
at the end of the day, like, yeah, I don't take the role of so seriously as that, as, you know, I am the motivator. Yeah. You know, it's like, man, we're all professional athletes. We're all there to do what we're going to do. And, you know, I don't think anything I'm going to say is going to, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I should whip up a serious inspirational speech, put some Braveheart music, get everyone going. But yeah, you know, like, I think everyone knows what they need to do. So yeah, of course, little fist bump for everybody. Let's get them. But yeah, nothing too serious.
I think you should go with, you're all grown men.
just turn
around and, you know, to whoever it is, Tom or Dan, just go, you're a grown man, get on the mat.
Look, you're all adult boys. You should be able to look after yourselves, right?
What have been your best experiences? You talked a little actually about, you know, the best experiences that people think you've had aren't the ones that they are to you. But the question is, what have been your best experiences as a coach and separately as a competitor?
Okay. As a competitor, the most proud moment I had, I won the European Championships in the black belt adult division for Nogi, for IBJJF. So for me, this was like a goal I had for a long time, something that I was working towards for a lot of years, and something I managed to achieve. And for me, this was electrifying feeling, most fulfilling feeling I've had in my career. The moment this happened, I felt completely content. If I never did another event again, if I never won anything again, this, it was something that really made me proud person on a personal level. So that's something that, you know, as I said, many people actually aren't aware of that as a title that I have. Most people always talk to me about the Kumite in 2012. It was like Lloyd Irvin's Kumite, which was like a no time limit submission only show. And this was amazing experience also, but this was something I just got put into, you know, it wasn't something I had worked towards or something that was a goal. So of course it was amazing and, you know, an amazing experience and time, but that's something that, man, this was nearly 10 years ago. And like day after day, every place that I go, everybody always remembers this. They're like, oh, you're in the Kumite. How was that? Oh, the Kumite was amazing, you know? And it's like, man, I spent my whole life trying to win black belt Europeans and I did it. And no one's ever asked me, you know? So like, that's what I think is funny, you know, like, or when I was a brown belt, I took third place in the Pan Ams in the middleweight division and I won 4 fights. I lost my 5th to take bronze, and man, a bronze medal, like, no one cares about bronze medals, but to me, it was huge at the time. I was like, man, to medal at a major competition like that, the middleweight division is always stacked. It's so full of talent. And even though I didn't win, this is something that I was very proud of, you know, like I didn't win the tournament, but I was like, damn, I medaled at, you know, one of the biggest tournaments in the world, coming from a very small situation. Okay, I didn't win, but, you know, I'm right there. My level is right there. It was like, it was something that made me really, really proud. But again, no one knows about that or no one cares about that. So it's those would be my like athletic moments, I think. As a coach, I've had a lot of like really, really proud moments, fortunately. For sure, the one that sticks out the most was Fionn's ADCC performance. Last ADCC was, you know, incredible. You know, for me, for a long time, the ADCC is, and it still is, it's the pinnacle of jiu-jitsu, you know. And to go from watching this tournament to having a student and a friend on the mat fighting and I'm sitting beside the mat, it, you know, was surreal. Very, very surreal experience, you know, like to actually be there and be sitting beside the mat and just to have her have that, you know, huge moment to be beating Bia. And you know, like, this was obviously something incredible, like something I'll never forget. Was electrifying. The crowd was insane. There was more people at that event than I've seen at any jiu-jitsu event. This was really, really fulfilling for me too. And then I think other ones as a coach, you know, I've had a bunch of my students win European titles as well. These were all really special. My students, Sam, Marcus, Shane Fishman, Ellis Younger won the Nogi World Championships brown belt 2019, which for someone who trains in Newcastle with virtually nobody is an insane accomplishment. So
So yeah, I've had a lot of really, really proud ones as a coach. I would say arguably more ones as a coach than as a athlete. But I think that's the nature of it, right? You have more chances to get those good moments. So yeah, I guess those would be a few of my coaching and athletic moments.
And I think there's something really, I mean, A, everyone should ask you now, from now on, anyone who listens to this needs to ask you if they see you about Europeans, just to make sure that you are at least asked that a few times.
Yeah. And but I'll save it for another time. So someone is really dying to ask me, but I have a really good story about this title also. So it's for another day, but this to me is a more interesting story than some of the other ones. So yeah, make sure if you see me next, you got to ask me, all right?
and I think to that, there is something just, it's hard to describe to people who've never coached from the side of the mat, but there is something just quite magical about seeing your student or seeing whoever you're coaching or cornering succeed at what they're after as well. Like you personally held such value and importance to the Europeans, that was your personal goal for so long. Similarly, when you see people and you see the work they've put into and you see it from an external perspective, it there's something quite magical about them seeing them succeed.
And it's one of the most amazing feelings I've experienced in my life, you know, to not exaggerate at all. It's gives me goosebumps to think about, you know, it really does. It's a truly amazing, fulfilling feeling.
And the final question, I think, again, this was the one that I think people are trying to nab techniques from you. But they've asked, what's your favorite submission chain or highest success submission chain and set up to get there?
Like in my career, for sure, like it's guillotine. I use a lot of the knee cut, like knee slice pass to the guillotine. But nowadays, man, I'm trying so hard to work on leg locks. Like every day when I train, I'm drilling leg locks, I'm specific training leg locks. When I'm rolling, I'm trying to do leg locks. I'm really trying to get into the leg locks for the last 2 years, especially. So I think now in training anyway, my most common submission chains are leg lock positions. So I'm still yet to hit any in competition. I you know, there's not so many tournaments I've had the opportunity to fight in where you're allowed to do them, but I still haven't done any in competition yet. I've had some students pull some off recently in competitions, which has been nice, but I still haven't hit any in competition. But in training, man, that's all I've been doing, you know, is just trying to do heel hooks for so long. And like I said, it's so much more available than guillotine. You know, if I train with someone and they know that I want to do a guillotine, or I've guillotined them a few times, it gets harder and harder to keep repeating it. You know, it's not as the access to the position is not as much there as others. So yeah, I think nowadays in training, my best submission chains are leg lock based. So hopefully I can bust out a few of those on next weekend.
And actually, as you were saying that, the thought came to me that we start, when we start jiu-jitsu, you know, you're getting rear naked choked or cross collar choked or guillotine from day one, and yet you don't get heel hooked, well, depending on what gym you are, you don't get heel hooked into a fair bit into your journey, depending on how many years you kind of it takes you to get to that point. And I think there's something in that the fact that it becomes second nature for you to understand is I'm at risk of getting dasted or getting guillotined. It just becomes solely ingrained into your subconscious.
Yep.
And so it does take for that kind of, you know, subconscious nature to just air, to be completely ingrained in leg locks, just comes later on for in people's jiu-jitsu journey.
Yeah, of course, like for sure, man. Then even for me, okay, my time attacking leg locks has increased tenfold. Well, my time defending like is still more minimal than my time attacking. And, you know, again, that comes down to where you trained. Like if you take people in New York, Danaher's team, or I know they've all separated now, it's old news, whatever, but you know, this team, and they've been attacking and defend. If you think when Gordon started heel hooking everyone in ADCC was 2017, when Eddie Cummings and Gary Tonin first started leg locking people in the EBIs, it was like 2015, 2014.
Yeah.
This is like 7 years ago, 7, 8 years ago at this point. Like, think how long 8 years worth of attacking and defending leg locks is versus the people who in 2017, when Gordon made it mainstream, decided, okay, I'm going to get into leg locks now. It's like you're years and years and years behind. No matter how much you understand it or how much you have time, you have half the time of the other people. So that's actually what was one of the most damaging things about heel hooks being illegal for so long, was just no one was doing them. And then people still, they tap so fast or they're unaware. You know, I put an analogy for my students. People are so scared of heel hooks and, you know, they're so afraid of being injured. It's like if someone barely touches your arm for a key lock or Americana and you just tap really fast, like, oh, that's so dangerous. Yeah. You know, geez, you're going to break my arm. But as people, the Americana or the key lock is one of the first submissions that you learn. And okay, it's arguably not as powerful as a heel hook, but just for analogy purposes, man, people just grit out Americanas all day. You know, they'll have it up beside their head. Their arm is twisted. Armbar. You're so used to being in an armbar from years and years and years that you can defend it at the early stage, the middle stage, the late stage, where your arm is completely out and you're running around trying to get yourself out of there because you've just been in it for so many years. You know the danger. You know, imagine if someone just grabs your neck for a guillotine and you tap. Sorry, man, that submission is so dangerous. You know, like, you're going to put me unconscious. I don't want to get hurt. Whereas with heel hooks, that's the way that it can still happen. You know, when I was in Brazil, yeah, the leg lock game is still behind over there. And when I was in Brazil, I was working my leg locks, and with some people, man, it was like almost unsatisfying. You would barely put them into the position and they're like, stop, because they think it's so dangerous. You know, they're like, no, you're going to break my leg. It's like, man, I'm not going to, that's like saying, if I put you in an armbar, I'm going to break your arm. Or it's like, I'll let go. You say stop, but only stop when it's actually working. You know, like it's a strange thing. So it's great that leg locks have been made legal, because it's going to make them less powerful as time goes on, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And there's something in it. If you're to take your key lock analogy, you learn the feeling of people setting it up. You learn what's it like to be in there. You learn how people manipulate you when they bring the elbow and they start bringing it down, that it's going to go on more tightly. You bring it higher, and it's all of that stuff, but you only learn whilst you're in the midst of it. And if you're tapping straight away when someone's just reached your leg, you're not going to do anything. You're not going to learn any of that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, of course it's powerful, but man, it's not that powerful. You know, it's as powerful as any other position. It's only powerful once it's applied correctly. It's not just in and of itself, oh, you pass your leg over and then, oh, my knee is going to explode. It's like, it doesn't work like that.
Exactly that. Well, we're going to come on to the final portion of the interview, which is a little quick fire round. Okay. We have some questions, which is some very stupid and amusing, and some that are related to jiu-jitsu, but they're a nice way of finishing out the interview. Nice. So the first one is, do you ever envisage a time where they do a gym versus gym squads or similar quintet event? So ECJJA versus a team, fill that space.
I think we're kind of far away from it, just because, well, I think you could do it with the bigger teams. Like, my team is not big enough and like well known enough on that level, but I think you could do Atos versus DDS, or you know, something like this, Checkmat versus Gracie Baja, something like that. I think that's a quicker reality than smaller teams like my own.
Who's the dark horse of each side of the squads? So for yourself, for your team, and for the other team as well.
I think Nick Ronan on their team. I trained with him when I was in New York, and although he's not probably as well known as like the other people. I think, man, he's very, very good. So if he can put his performance together, I think he's the only one who I think, man, everyone, you're not a dark horse if you're Roberto Jimenez, you know, everyone, you're a bright shining horse that everyone can see, you know. So I think Nick Ronan, probably just because not many people know him, I think he's a dark horse for their team. And on our team, I think, you know, I suppose the only one you can say would be a dark horse is Jed, because he's not as experienced or as like accomplished with titles just yet as the others. You know, I always think Tom Halpin is a dark horse because he's not so vocal on social media. He's a quiet guy and he's very, very good. So, you know, I would say him, but he had the only submission on the last one. So, you know, I guess people are expecting him to do good this time too. So I guess I'd say Jed, just because I know he's very dangerous with the leg locks. And I think he has the ability to submit someone where, you know, everyone knows Gio Martinez, but not many people know Jed Hugh. And if Jed Hugh submits Gio Martinez, it's a much bigger deal than if Gio Martinez submits Jed Hugh. Yeah, you understand what I mean? So yeah. I would go with Nick Ronan and Jed, just because they're the least established of the competitors.
I like that. Choice of coffee, if you do drink coffee, if not choice of caffeine.
Oh, I mean, you just mean like flat white, cappuccino, that type of thing? Espresso, man. Espresso all the way. And most of the time, if I'm tired, a triple or even a quadruple espresso, that does it for me.
Bloody hell. Is there kind of a coffee machine right by the mat side, or is there just an endless supply of coffee at the gym?
I live across the street from the gym, like quite literally across the street, and I have all forms of coffee here. I have French press, I have a stovetop, I have an espresso machine if I need a quick one. I've got it all very, very close proximity. I like energy drinks as well. Like, I'm partial to a Monster or a Nocco is another one that's good too. But I try not to do it like too often, because like those things can't be good for you, right? Like,
I just can't believe that it's pure whatever they call it. I'm gonna stick with the coffee.
I try to drink the ones with no sugar, because that makes me feel better about myself. Like, oh, there's no sugar. But like, what the hell? If it's at least sugar is a real substance, you know? Like, what the hell is, if it's not sugar, what is making it taste like that, you know? So I try not to have them too regularly. But if you're really tired and you want to get a good buzz, like, I'm not going to pretend like I don't get one in every so often.
Exactly. My analogy for energy drink, specifically Monster, is coffee is my daily. And then, for example, when I drive to Wales, like, Monster is my like break glass for emergency buttons.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good one. I like that.
What's been your favorite show or event that you've competed at? I feel like this is going to be Euros, but it may not be.
No, the Euros was my favorite to win, but the BJJ Kumite was the coolest for sure. Just because it was so nuts, you know, like, it was so crazy fighting submission only for 6 matches a day for a whole week. Like, this is something that'll never be replicated again, and was so, so crazy. So that was the most fun, just because it was so challenging mentally, physically. Like, the Kumite was the most crazy and the most fun for sure, I think.
Where we get to? What's your post-fight treat?
Oof. I'm a big man for chocolate. I like chocolate a lot. So anything chocolate related can be chocolate ice cream, actual chocolate itself, chocolate crepes, chocolate cake. If it's got chocolate, I'll be happy.
So a massive sweet tooth then.
Man, much bigger than I'd care to admit.
Again, the house is right opposite the gym. It's a dangerous thing.
This is it.
Who's your favorite, you know, in, it doesn't have to, well, I could say alive or dead, but who's your favorite BJJ fighter, or is there someone that you really look up to?
my goat for so long was Marcelo Garcia. Like, I think people of my generation, my size, it was always Marcelo, man. Like, 5-time IBJJF Gi World Champion, 4-time ADCC World Champion, absolute silver medalist, absolute bronze medalist at ADCC. The guy was just an innovator, an example in how he acted and how he fought. Like, he was just a combination of everything, you know, someone who always fought to try to finish, someone who was always respectful, someone who, you know, won everything Gi and no Gi. For me, it was always him. Nowadays, I have a lot of people I like, you know, like athletes that I like to watch. Like I said, Tommy Langacker, the guy's amazing. I love watching him. There's plenty of other people I like to watch, but kind of my goat would be Marcelo. He was always my favorite.
And then last two questions. What's something that people don't know? Like, do you have a hobby outside BJJ that people might not guess?
I have a few hobbies. I don't want to say I'm good, but I can play the piano and guitar relatively well. If you don't know about playing piano and guitar, I probably seem like I'm amazing. That's my secret. I can make myself. It's like if you don't know jiu-jitsu and you see someone doing flying arm bars, you know, you think they're amazing, but they could actually suck. Mm-hmm. You know? So it's like I'm good at making myself seem much better at piano and guitar than I am. So yeah, I can play a bit of piano, a bit of guitar. That's maybe something people don't know.
I like that. And finally, if someone were to play you in a movie, who would it be and what kind of movie would it be?
Oh, wow. If I'm supposed to just go off of pure image, Vin Diesel would be my go-to just because he has no hair.
He's family.
Yeah. Probably go for Vin Diesel because I like to think that I'm in good nick and I have no hair. So that would be my... That's the only person I can think of who's bald. The Rock, he's bald as well nowadays, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't go Jason Statham.
Jason Statham, man, he's probably more handsome than the other two, though, isn't he? Like, in the girl's perspective.
True.
So maybe that could have been a better call. But and The Rock is too tanned, actually, isn't he? He'd have to put on a lot of makeup to make himself look extremely pale.
And what kind of movie would it be?
My go-to is action, but I don't know how action-packed in my life. My life really is.
So Vin Diesel playing the piano whilst beating up bad guys and cornering ADCC, and then he goes and fights the Kumite.
Yeah, there you go. Bit of a romantic action film.
And then at the end of the film, maybe you turn to, I don't know, Danaher, and you just look at him and you just say, family.
Sounds good.
Well, Dara, thank you very much for coming on. All the best for this Saturday. We look forward to the squad's next outing. But it was a pleasure having you on.
Thanks so much, man. Thanks for chatting. And yeah, just let's have some fun. Go do our best. And enjoy the weekend. It's going to be awesome.
Remember, it's you're all grown men. That's the line.
That's it, man. I don't want to see any tears. I don't see any nothing. You're a grown man. Deal with it, all right?
I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. To keep up to date with all our latest stuff, follow us at The Prodigy Podcast on Instagram.